Today we look at Christ's betrayal, where, you know, as we've looked at John's gospel, he's very clear in stating the purpose why he wrote his gospel. In chapter 20, verse 31, he says, "But these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name." So, as we look at John's Gospel, chapters 2 to 12, we read about Jesus' life and His ministry. He's presenting Himself to the world, or really more specifically, to Israel. And he validates that he is indeed the Messiah, the long-awaited one, by his teachings, his signs, his miracles and wonders. Then in chapters 13 to 17, which we just concluded, and we took a considerable time going through there, and so did the Apostle John in writing it, but it actually covered a very short period of time of Jesus with his disciples. There was just a lot there. And these chapters were a time of Jesus' final teachings and instructions to his disciples, because these were the men that would be put in charge of planting the church of Jesus Christ. So it was a time where he demonstrated his love for all of his followers, but especially the disciples. And it ended with his prayer in chapter 17, where he prays for his glory to be restored. He prays for his disciples, their safety, their spiritual health, and then for all the believers to come. So now we come to the climax of the Gospel of John as we look at Jesus' betrayal, his arrest, his trial, his death, and his resurrection that are in chapters 18 through 21. So there is also a difference in the Apostle John's approach to this last few hours of Jesus' life and that of Matthew and Mark. Matthew and Mark were concerned and they wanted people to see the suffering of Jesus. So they wanted people to see Jesus as not only God, but the suffering man. And so they wrote about Jesus' humiliation. They wrote about his graphic sufferings and his torture. And as we just saw, I read out of chapter 20 in the book of John that his purpose was, "These have been written that you may believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name." So John's primary concern is showing the deity of Jesus Christ. And I think as we continue and we explore this, you're going to see how John, this comes out in John. But before we continue, I'd also like to make a point. See, contrary to fairly common belief, Jesus was not a victim. He was not swept up by events that he had no control of, or he was able to orchestrate. He was not blindsided. You know, a few chapters back in John, chapter 10, John, we find Jesus giving the reason that he does what he does. He says, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father." So, Jesus came to earth for one primary purpose, And that was to fulfill the plan of God, die, pay for the sins of mankind, that people would be able to be reconciled back to God. The prophet Isaiah spoke of Jesus having to pay this price to redeem current believers and all future believers. And he wrote about this 700 years before Christ was born. And this just demonstrates then the knowledge, the glory, and the preeminence of God. If you'll turn in your Bibles to the section in the Old Testament for major prophets, chapter 53 of Isaiah, I'm going to spend a little time going through the first 11 verses and putting in some of my commentary. And I want you to, as I go through these, I want you to think about this last night of Jesus Christ. I want you to sit and think about the cross that will be coming soon. So now, if you'll let me, I will begin reading in chapter 53, verse 1. It says, "Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" Now, Isaiah speaks of the coming Messiah here. Beginning in verse 2, he says, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground." Now, I don't think anybody has to think too hard that Israel at this point of Jesus Christ has become a spiritual wasteland. It has become dry ground. And so Isaiah, the Lord put this in Isaiah's heart and mind. Isaiah knew this. And then he continues speaking of Jesus, and he says that Jesus had no form of or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. So if you think about it, there was nothing really special about Jesus' outward appearance. I mean, he wasn't the handsome leader that King David was. And he certainly wasn't the conquering king that so many at the time of Christ were hoping would come and defeat the Romans and kick them out of Israel. And that's what they had been waiting for. Then in verse 3, it says, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not." Verse 4 continues and says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and we have esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted." You know, some things simply don't change. I mean, at the time of Isaiah, most of the prophets were abused and mistreated. At the time of Christ, Israel in general did not esteem Christ because, as we said, it had become a spiritual wasteland. People were spiritually dead. And today, people do not esteem Jesus Christ because they don't want to be convicted of their sin. They want to live whatever life they want to live. So as we continue to read in Isaiah, we see what has to now happen in order for Jesus to atone for the sins of all mankind that God has called. Taking up again in verse 5, it says, "But he," Jesus, "was pierced for our transgressions." Now we know from history that Jesus was pierced by a spear from the Roman guard while he was up on the cross. "And he was crushed for our iniquities. And upon him was the chastisement, thank you, that brought us peace. And with his wounds," it says, "we are healed." So, in verse 6, it says, "We are all like sheep and have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way." And isn't that so true? before you were saved, you are totally like a lost sheep, going your own way, doing your own thing. And then it says, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. See, Jesus paid the atoning price for all of mankind, but only those the Father has called respond to Jesus. See, Isaiah continues speaking of Jesus' trial that is soon coming in the John. It says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, and yet he opened not his mouth. And remember, during the trial, he remained silent, and that's the reason they couldn't convict him of anything wrong. So Jesus remained silent before the chief priests. And Isaiah is speaking of Jesus now in the next few verses. It's about his trail, his carrying the cross up to Golgotha. And he says, like a lamb that was led to slaughter, and like sheep that is before the shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for this generation who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people. Isaiah even talks about Jesus, as you see it in retrospect, being put on the cross between two criminals and then being put in a tomb owned by the wealthy man, Joseph of Arimathea. I'm having problems this morning, who was a believer in Jesus. It says in verse 9, it says, and they made his grave with the wicked. So that's, he's been between the two criminals, and with the rich man, Joseph, who gave his own tomb, who had never been used. And in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. So why did Jesus then have to suffer these terrible things that God revealed to Isaiah 700 years before Jesus was even born? We find that in answer in verse 10. It says, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him, to crush Jesus, and he has put him to grief. And when his soul makes an offering of guilt, he shall see his offering, his offspring, which is all believers, is what he's talking about there. And he shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. And then in verse 11, it says, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By the knowledge shall his righteous one, by my servant, make many to account for righteousness, and he shall bear their iniquities. Now, what I find amazing is as we read Isaiah, we can see God's purpose. 700 years before Christ was born, we see that God has the knowledge, he has a plan, and he has a plan for our salvation that even Isaiah knew about 700 years before Christ. And in truth, there was this plan for our salvation before the creation of the universe. And I find it also amazing that the Jewish rabbis can study chapter 53 of Isaiah and not see Jesus in it. I mean, but then if you think about it, isn't this the same fate that all spiritually blind and spiritually dead people pay? They simply do not see the truth of the scriptures. Now, Jesus, in this next area, he echoes what Isaiah wrote and spoke of. He was speaking to the people about what was coming. And then in chapter 12, he says, now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have glorified it and will glorify it again. the crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said an angel had spoken to Jesus. And then Jesus answers and says, "This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of the world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out," speaking of Satan. "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Here he's speaking all people that God has predestined and called. And then in verse 33, he says, "He said this to show what kind of death he was going to die." See, the end is here. The time is now. Jesus' final hours are at hand. So now as we turn our attention to the account of these last few hours of Jesus in his earthly life in chapter 18, John is going to focus on the deity of Christ. But if you want a more complete picture, you want to see everything that Jesus goes through and suffers, then this coming week you should read Matthew 26 to 27 and Mark 14 to 15. Because they add different elements to what Jesus goes through in these last few hours. John's focus and our focus this morning is on Jesus' majesty. We're going to look at three areas: Jesus' divine control, his supremacy, and his obedience. Jesus is in control of this whole situation. He is going to fulfill God's plan down to the very last detail. He orchestrates the time and the place of his arrest. He protects his disciples, and even his enemies are in truth fulfilling the plan of God. So the end is near. Jesus' time of instruction is over. The events are going to quickly unfold now. So let me read beginning in chapter 18, verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook of Kidron. And there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. This is what Jerusalem at the time looked like. This is Kidron down here. And they had to travel a path going out of through the Kidron Valley. And this is a slope going up to the Mount of Olives. So Jesus and his small band of disciples have left Jerusalem. They're crossing over the Kidron, which means dark, and which the Jews would call a wadi. We would call it an arroyo. It is dry most of the time. It only carries water in the winter months when it actually is raining. And the first time that Kidron is mentioned in the scriptures is when King David's son Absalom rebels in an attempt to take the crown of David, and David had to flee Jerusalem. It says in 2 Samuel 15:23, it says, "While all the country was weeping in a loud voice, all the people passed over. The King David also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over towards the way of the wilderness." So just as treachery and betrayal followed King David across Kidron, it also follows Jesus. And in that way, they go through some of the same things. Jesus and his disciples left Jerusalem, went down the curvy road that you can barely see, partially back up on the Mount of Olives, to the garden, which was 2 miles from Jerusalem. John doesn't name the garden, but we know from Matthew and Mark that the name of the garden is Gethsemane, which means oil press. From Luke's gospel, we also know that this garden is where Jesus often met with his disciples. And Judas knew this place well, and Judas knew that Jesus would be found here. It was at this location that Jesus gave what we call the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. And that should say Matthew 24, not 23. And it was from this garden that he spoke in 24 all the signs that must come about before Jesus would return for his second coming and the final time. It was also, this garden was away from the noise and the crowds of Jerusalem. The Roman historian Traianus estimated the population of Jerusalem at this time was over 600,000. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote that he thought the population was about 1 million. It doesn't matter each way, but during the Passover, which we are now looking at, the population of Jerusalem would have been over 1 million people because of all the pilgrims that were coming there. So the garden offered a quiet and secluded place where Jesus could go and begin to pour out his heart to his Father. And we realize because of Jesus, then this is our Father also. And God, who is now our Father, listens to our prayers just as he listened to Jesus' prayers. Jesus is also, if you think about it, he's controlling the place of his arrest by going to this garden. The Pharisees had attempted to arrest Jesus over the last couple years several times and failed because they were not in control. Jesus was. And Jesus remains in control even during this arrest. And now the outworking of God's plan of redemption and salvation is going to be brought to its fulfillment. And Jesus would now offer his life as for the sins of mankind. So Jesus chose this secluded place because Jerusalem is filled to the overflowing with pilgrims for the Passover. And many of those pilgrims that came from the outlying areas were supporters of Jesus. So, if Jesus was arrested in Jerusalem, it had the potential for creating a number of problems. Even riots or insurrection against Jewish leaders and the Romans. And this is why the Jewish leaders in the past had always plotted to try to arrest Jesus in secret, because they didn't want the populace to rise up against them. And the Jewish leaders thought this garden where they're going to go try and go to arrest Jesus worked out perfect for their plans because it's secluded and it's outside of Jerusalem. However, it was Jesus that was in control, not them. And Jesus didn't want to be such a focal point in Jerusalem that a riot would break out and people would then surely die, including the disciples. They could easily be attacked or killed if this took place in Jerusalem. And it's these disciples that have to plant the future church. So Jesus wouldn't have wanted to risk that either. Remember earlier in the evening, Jesus had ejected Judas from the fellowship of him and his disciples. And then Judas went and met with the chief priests and made the final arrangements for betraying Jesus, thus fulfilling the will of God. Now, if we go back to John 18 and take up our passage in verse 2, we read, "Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns, torches, and weapons." Now, if you have an English Standard translation, it says band of soldiers. Now, most of the translations say band of soldiers. However, the New American Standard says a Roman cohort. Now, a Roman cohort was between 600 and 1,000 soldiers. if it wasn't a cohort, then it was a detachment, and that number ranged between 200 and 300 soldiers. And this may have been more likely. However, the Romans were known for not taking chances. They always showed power. Now, if you'll remember back in Acts chapter 23, when they had arrested Apostle Paul, the Romans dispatched 470 soldiers to escort him from Jerusalem to Caesarea. In Acts 23:23, it says, the Roman tribune called the two centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea on the third hour of the night." So they were going to take no chances with Paul that anybody would be able to rescue him or he would be able to escape. And so the Roman soldiers were known for not taking chances. So now if you think about it, how many of you thought that in this night in the garden that there were at least 200 to 600 soldiers accompanying the Jewish officers, which were most likely temple guards, to arrest Jesus? And they did this so they could prevent an uprising of any of the people from Jerusalem. I mean, that's a huge number. So, and you think about it, Jerusalem is just teeming with people because of the Passover. And so here in the middle of the night comes 200 to 600 soldiers plus all the Jews marching out of Jerusalem. People had to be going, what's going on? What's happening here? You know, and John, who writes this gospel account, we know that he had to be an eyewitness, because who would have written the fact that in the second half of verse 3, that this massive number of men were carrying lanterns, torches, and weapons? Only an eyewitness would know these kind of details. And what also is interesting, the Passover is always celebrated during a full moon. And so really the need for lanterns and torches was not all that great. But John makes this interesting note. Then John gives evidence of Jesus' deity and his ability to know all when in verse 4 John wrote, he said, "Then Jesus, knowing all," and how much is all? It's everything, "that the world that would happen to him, he came forward and said to them, 'Who do you seek?'" Jesus was waiting for this army. He wasn't taken by surprise. He steps out in front and keeps all of his disciples behind him to protect them. And Jesus takes charge of the whole situation. He stood there, one man against hundreds of soldiers, and they didn't challenge him. He stays in charge. And so the soldiers didn't approach him. They knew who he was. They didn't approach him and bind him and take him away, because Judas was with them, but Judas had not given the agreed upon sign that we'll talk about later. And so Jesus' response probably went over the heads of the Roman soldiers, but his response surely did not be, it wasn't missed by the Jewish temple guards, by Judas, or any of the other Jews that were attending. This is one of the points that I think here is important to look at. This is where I honestly disagree with all the Bible translations. I want to show you something that I think is so important in this part of the story. See, they added a word that they thought should be there because it was implied by the context of the story. But that word is not in the original Greek. And it softens the impact of what Jesus says, and actually even changes what Jesus says. If you look at verse 5 again, it says in the original Greek, I am. But they added the word he. That word shouldn't be there. The gospel, according to John, is often referred to as the gospel of the seven great I ams. I am the way, the truth, the light of the world, the bread of life. I am the vine, the gate, the resurrection, and the good shepherd. I think we are seeing the eighth great I am in Jesus' response to these band of soldiers. This would have made those in front, the Jews that were leading all the Roman soldiers, pause and think twice about arresting Jesus and taking him by force. This exchange repeats itself, and in doing so, it makes it clear that they have come for Jesus, not the disciples, and Jesus makes clear who he is. Reading in verses 5 to 9, Jesus said to them, I am. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. And when Jesus said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. I mean, isn't this a demonstration of Jesus' power? I mean, it doesn't say that some drew back and fell to the ground. It says they, and in the context, we are talking about hundreds of men are thrown back and thrown to the ground by the mere words of Jesus Christ as Lord. Now, reading from verse 7, it says, so he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am. See, this second time that Jesus says this, he's saying again, I am God. He uses the very same name that God used when he spoke to Moses. If you want to go to Exodus chapter 3, it says, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. See, when Jesus was being arrested, twice using the same name for himself as God used when he identified himself to Moses, Jesus answers and says, I told you, I am. Now, doesn't this change the entire impact of this exchange in this story? Jesus finishes his reply in verse 8 of John 18 saying, so if you seek me, let these men go. He's talking about his disciples. Jesus, always the good shepherd, continues to protect those that God has given and put in his trust. See, Jesus kept his disciples from being arrested. He protects them because they are the future of the church. And I love Peter. You know, at this point in the story, Peter, he's a man of conviction. He's a man of action. He's often rash. I can relate to that. And he may have faltered after the arrest of Jesus and had some weak moments. But if we read in Acts, we see how passionate, how strong Peter's preaching is. And he brings hundreds, if not thousands of people to give their lives to Christ. So let me finish our time in God's Word this morning by looking at verses 10 and 11 of chapter 18. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name is Malchus, and that means either king or the servant of king. And so Jesus says to Peter in verse 11, he says to Peter, put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me. See, John does not mention what Luke does. But Jesus said in Luke, he says, no more of this, talking to Peter. And then he touched the ear of the servant and he healed him. See, as much as I want to say to Peter, right on, cut that booger's ear off, right? Protect Christ. I also then, it points out to me that Peter still did not understand that Jesus had been teaching him that he had to die in order to pay the price for everybody's sin and bring salvation to the world. I mean, after all, wasn't it Peter that said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God? I mean, this is recorded in Matthew 16 when they were discussing what the people were saying about Jesus Christ. And Jesus looks at the disciples and he says, who do you say I am? And Peter responds, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answers Peter and he says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I struggle and have a hard time understanding how Peter, just a few months before, could have been so strong in his conviction and understanding of who Jesus was. And now he's bold. He stands forward and he cuts off this guy's ear. But he's clueless as to why all this is happening. And Jesus has been teaching him every day what he had to do. Jesus has been teaching him that he could not deny what God had called him to do in these final hours. Back in chapter 18 of John, verse 11, Jesus rebukes Peter, saying, put your sword into your sheath. Shall I not drink this cup that the Father has given me? See, what Jesus is doing, even among this ruckus, these men have come to arrest him, what he's still doing is teaching. He's teaching his disciples, and specifically he's teaching Peter that Jesus must be obedient to the Father, just as the disciples are to be obedient to Christ, and just as we today as believers are to be obedient to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. Jesus says that he must drink this cup given to him by the Father, and this cup is going to be drained on the cross. It will take the mortal life of Jesus. And this was done, as Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. It says, for our sake, God made Jesus to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become righteous, the righteousness of God. See, Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, the cup of his mortal life was drained, and you and I, through this process, become righteous before God the Father. So with the understanding of what Jesus is preparing to do, what he is teaching his disciples, now it's time to prepare for Holy Communion, for the Lord's Supper.